ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning and welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 29th of June. I'm Barbara Miller, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. A Four Coroners investigation has uncovered new evidence about the scale of brain disease among former Australian rules footballers. Until now, only five players were known to have been diagnosed with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, a degenerative brain disease linked to repeated head impacts. But Four Coroners can reveal that the number of Aussie rules players diagnosed after death is much higher. Among them, West Coast Eagles Premiership player Adam Hunter, who died last year. Jessica Halloran has this report.
Moose takes Hunter out with him.
Adam Hunter put his body on the line for years, playing for the West Coast Eagles.
He could be in trouble here, Hunter.
Well, as a mother, it made me feel sick and worried, but back then I didn't know what head knocks could do.
Adam had a starring role in the 2006 grand final, but his mother and stepfather, Joanne and Rod, started to notice changes in him soon after.
His personality changed, addictions started coming in.
Adam increasingly turned to drugs, and he died early last year from an overdose. Adam's parents donated his brain and discovered he was suffering from a degenerative brain disease called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. Until now, only five Australian rules football players have been known to have CTE. Four Coroners can exclusively reveal the number is actually 33, six times higher than previously known. Michael Buckland is the director of the Australian Sports Brain Bank and diagnosed the players. He says all contact sports carry the risk of CTE.
The vast majority of cases of CTE in the Sports Brain Bank from people that have played collision sports, Australian rules football, rugby league, rugby union. However, we still have other donors with CTE that have played other sports that have had lots of head impacts.
The disease is caused by repetitive hits to the head and body and can cause problems with mood, memory, and impulse control. It can only be diagnosed after death. Adam's parents told Four Coroners about his symptoms.
Addictive behaviour.
Lack of confidence.
Yeah, and not fully being able to concentrate on things.
The Australian Sports Brain Bank needs more donors in order to achieve a more accurate view of how common CTE is in Australian rules footballers. On the other side of the world, in her Boston brain bank, Dr. Anne McKee has been working on the holy grail of a diagnosis of CTE in life. She says the discovery would be revolutionary for people experiencing symptoms they can't explain.
I expect to be able to diagnose CTE during life within the next 3 years. To understand that there is a disease, a brain injury that is causing these symptoms, that realization is extraordinary for patients.
We asked the AFL's CEO, Andrew Dillon, to be interviewed for this story. He declined. Instead, AFL executive Laura Kane spoke to Four Coroners. She says the AFL has brought in 30 rule changes over the past decade and has a long-term study into brain health underway.
We're committed to a long-term study that includes brain donation, and we will make sure that we deliver that research program with the overlay of brain donation if our players want to, in the safest way possible.
Jessica Halloran reporting, and you can see her Four Coroners anytime on ABC iView. The stories of miracle rescues are becoming fewer and further between in Venezuela as a desperate search continues to find survivors after twin quakes hit the country last week. The official death toll has now risen above 1,400, but is expected to climb significantly. North America correspondent Lauren Day is following developments. Lauren, I guess hopes are really starting to fade now that more people will be pulled out.
Yeah, that's right, Barb. There's that crucial 72-hour window after any disaster that most experts and aid groups say is when most people can be saved. So it's really a race against time now for these thousands of international and local rescue workers who are picking through all the debris. They're using dogs to sniff out survivors. They're listening for any signs of life under those flattened buildings. And we're seeing a number of these stories of miracle rescues emerging, you know, babies and children trapped for days who are being dragged dragged out alive against the odds. But as we know, those stories are likely to become increasingly rare with every hour that passes. So the death toll at the moment stands at just above 1,400 people, although that hasn't been updated today. But thousands are injured and some 50,000 people remain unaccounted for. So the US Geological Survey is estimating that the death toll could reach more than 10,000 people.
And we're seeing some pretty harrowing scenes, aren't we? People still trying to sing out to relatives who they believe might be trapped.
Absolutely. It's devastating to watch people call out for their loved ones, trying to listen to any signs of life. But as well as that sadness, there's a lot of anger growing from citizens in Venezuela about what they say has been a really slow government response. You know, people poured towards La Guaira, the worst hit area, when this happened with their own aid, and volunteers came with picks and shovels to try to help the rescue efforts because they didn't trust the official response. But many of them have since been barred from some of the disaster zones by the military, and that's caused a lot of anger. That's because they were reportedly jamming up the roads and causing traffic chaos, and the official emergency vehicles couldn't get in themselves. So the leader, Delcy Rodriguez, who we know Donald Trump helped bring to power when US forces arrested Nicolas Maduro at the start of the year, has come under a lot of pressure, and this is going to be a major test of her very fragile government. She's been trying to comfort citizens. She's been touring these disaster zones, but she's been heckled by a lot of very angry citizens who say her government simply hasn't done enough.
Lauren Day there. Dr. Andres Ortiz is a gastroenterologist based in Caracas. He's been volunteering at one of the city's hospitals through the UK-based charity Healing Venezuela. And while people are still being pulled from the rubble, not everyone who makes it to hospital pulls through.
Particularly, there's one story from my son that's a medical student. He had four friends who lived in an apartment down in La Guaira. And at the moment of the earthquake, the building collapsed and three of them died. And one of them survived. He was in the rubble for around 10, 12 hours. Then they rescued him. He contacted his friends, the medical students. They were at the hospital. They were waiting for him. Even the professors from trauma and trauma shock area were waiting for him, but he didn't make it. He died on the way.
Wow. And do you get the sense that hospitals have enough staff, enough resources to deal with the emergency?
It was really covered with personnel because all the medical students in the last year of the medical career were there, and it was pretty much covered. Now, talking about medical supplies, they did have a lot of deficit with medical supplies.
What's needed there?
A lot of things. I talked to the people in trauma shock area, and they wanted immobilizers. They wanted casks. And something that he said that they needed a lot was hygiene products for the patients to sterilize the patients and all this. And they also needed detergent and bleach to sterilize the area because they didn't have enough sterilizing products for cleaning up the area
and
where they work.
Those are things that your charity is now going to try and send to Venezuela?
Yes, they already did send a first package with a lot of things. But now what we are concentrating for tomorrow, for next week, is blood banks. They're scarce with all the serological blood tests they have to do before they can administrate the blood to the patients. And also all the syringes they need and all the different specialized equipment they need for the blood banks.
And we also hear that some people are sleeping on the street. Have you seen that?
Yes, yes, yes. In the parks, there were people sleeping in tents. And a lot of those people who were sleeping in tents were people that lived in buildings that were affected by the earthquake, but they were waiting for specialized engineers, structural engineers, to tell them if their building was safe or not, so they can go back into the apartments. People are very, very nervous of the replicas.
The aftershocks,
university. Yeah, the aftershocks.
Have you felt much of aftershock?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, yes. I think it was yesterday, there was a 5.0 aftershock. We felt it pretty much.
It must be scary to be there now.
Yeah, and everybody has that trauma after that huge earthquake. Every time you kind of feel the earth shaking, people get really, really nervous.
Dr. Andres Ortiz from the Healing Venezuela charity speaking to me from Caracas. Iran and the US are trading strikes and barbs, and that's despite ongoing attempts to flesh out a memorandum of understanding. Bridget Rollison reports from Jerusalem.
After days of relative calm in the Middle East conflict came this. Iran launching missiles and drones at US military bases in Kuwait and Bahrain in the first attack since the 60-day ceasefire deal was agreed nearly 2 weeks ago.
As we predicted from the outset and continue to do so, the enemy is deceptive, untrustworthy, and prone to breaking its commitments. We've repeatedly said that if the enemy once again breaks its commitments or violates the ceasefire, our response will be stronger than before.
Iran's Revolutionary Guards spokesperson, Hossein Mohebi, says Tehran was responding to US strikes on its missile factories and coastal radar sites. The US says those strikes were in retaliation for attacks on two ships in the Strait of Hormuz, hours after Iran warned vessels against using what it called an unauthorized route, hugging the Omani coast. Here's the Iranian Foreign Minister, Abbas Araghchi.
Any attempt to adopt new or separate arrangements from those currently being implemented by the Islamic Republic of Iran will only complicate the situation, delay the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, and raise the level of tension.
Tehran was supposed to fully reopen the strait as part of the Memorandum of Understanding signed with Washington. The agreement stipulates Iran will use its best efforts to ensure ships could pass safely and work with Oman on the future administration of the waterway. But for Iran, reopening the strait doesn't mean giving up control, so it can keep the waterway as a bargaining chip in negotiations. These latest attacks signalling Tehran wants to decide which route ships can take. Principal freight analyst at Kipler, Matthew Wright, says that approach will make it harder for traffic to return to normal.
If Iran tries to maintain control, they will want vessels to take the Iranian route so that they can exert that control. There's a fundamental limitation in getting back to normal transits that way, because the navigation is trickier. You've got to go through tighter choke points around the islands.
The US Central Command insists ships are still moving through the Strait of Hormuz. Mr. Wright says traffic had climbed to its highest level since before the conflict, until these strikes put that progress at risk.
And there's still a high level of distrust that the IRGC will be true to their word and say it's open, because we've had this before, right? We've had these false dawns where they think we're safe to go.
The ceasefire deal was meant to bring calm to the region. Instead, a dangerous back and forth is unfolding once again. This is Bridget Rollison in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
To federal politics, and the Greens are demanding an investigation into foreign-run Facebook pages which are monetizing politically themed fake news and AI content. Political reporter Sarah Tomevska has more.
Stop the boats!
That's not a real woman's voice. It's an AI-generated outrage bot published on a pro-One Nation Facebook page.
We need proper reform of the whole broken system.
Investigations by the ABC and The Guardian have found some of the largest pro-One Nation Facebook pages are operating out of Asia, in Vietnam, Indonesia and the Philippines.
Content farms really have been around as a phenomenon in Southeast Asia, going back to at least the 2000s. And they've become really popularly used, I think, around the world. Some of these content producers and bot farms are used for campaigns in the United States, for content in Australia. So it's become a global phenomenon.
Gatra Priyandita is a senior analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He says content farms often shape public opinion by driving engagement through outrage. But the people behind the pages are generally motivated by money, not ideology.
A lot of them are young people. They may have just come out of university. A lot of them struggle to get jobs since COVID. Many end up joining these businesses or try to freelance as a way to benefit and make use of their degrees.
Who chooses what kind of content is made?
That's always a bit uncertain, right? I mean, on the one hand, I think you do have political operators working for certain parties or certain individuals commissioning a lot of the work. But then you may also have people who are perhaps some sympathizers, right, to certain political views or politicians that may commission the work. So it's never really entirely clear.
Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young is demanding answers.
One Nation has some serious questions to answer about what's really going on and what is really boosting their political campaign here in Australia. This type of foreign interference in a political party and a political campaign must be investigated.
A spokesman for One Nation says social media platforms clearly aren't scrutinising the establishment of online accounts to the best of their ability or acting fast enough to suspend suspicious accounts, adding if social media companies won't act voluntarily to safeguard Australians from the onslaught of AI scams and malicious fake posts, it may require further legislative intervention. According to Communications Minister Annika Wells, there are no plans on that front for now.
Sarah Tomevska, the end of the tax year is fast approaching and you might be tempted to get AI to help you complete your return. But the tax office is warning people to be mindful that they are ultimately responsible for any errors. Oliver Gordon reports.
Miriam Fiorenza is a bookkeeper by trade but runs a dog walking business on the side.
We are special because we do individual walks. So, for example, today we did 10 different walks. They were all individuals.
It's a handy way to make some extra cash each week.
I would say between 300 to 500 per week before taxes.
But when it comes to tax time, having a side hustle can make things complicated. Miriam has used AI to help her work out how much tax she owes, but says she wouldn't rely on it totally.
I will always say you can rely 80%, but 20% I think humans still can get to finish off the job.
As the end of financial year draws closer, you may be tempted to use generative AI systems like ChatGPT or Google Gemini to help you file your tax return. RMIT University Professor of Finance Angel Zhong says that's a bad idea.
Even for the most simple tax situation, AI can't replace your judgment.
The professor's research has shown some mainstream AI chatbots are using old information.
Some AI platforms are trained on the previous 3 to 5 years of data.
Anita Challen is Assistant Commissioner with the Australian Tax Office and is warning the community to be mindful of information gathered through AI chatbots.
You're still ultimately accountable for what you put in your tax return.
And what should people with side hustle businesses be aware of when they go to file their tax return this year?
The first thing is to remember that you might be running a business if you're running a side hustle. And it's important to know because, of course, there are different tax obligations if you're running a business as compared to something that you might be doing just as a hobby or for recreational activity.
The Assistant Commissioner says determining whether you're running a business or hobby comes down to whether or not you're doing it with the intention to make a profit.
There's some really great information on our website. You can type in, am I running a business? And that'll take you through a checklist that will give you advice with regards to whether or not the side hustle is a business and what those obligations are.
Assistant Commissioner Challen doesn't believe everyone selling items online is necessarily in business. But she says if you're making money ride sourcing through apps like Uber, it's probably a different story.
You probably are running a business. And the second is in terms of your obligations, you may need to register for GST.
The end of financial year is tomorrow.
Oliver Gordon. And that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Barbara Miller.
Hi, Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As a nation, it's a sport we love, Aussie rules, but it comes with a risk of head knocks for those who play it. And new figures reveal a big increase in the number of players known to have the brain disease, CTE, after their deaths. Today, Four Corners reporter Jess Halloran on her investigation. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.